first the music of sadness, or gultry, to make the women in his audience weep. Then the music of happiness, or gantry, to cause the young people to burst into hysterics. And finally, the music of meditation, or suntri, to lull his audience to sleep. The literary and musical connections among the Celtic-speaking regions are certainly close, even if we're not always sure how they were formed. The final instrument that Gerald tells us about is the pipes. The pipes are yet another example of something that came to the Celtic world from elsewhere and then developed into something distinctive. There are many different kinds of pipes, but most of them have several things in common. The first is the fact that they use enclosed reeds that are fed from a reservoir of air in a bag. The air can be provided by blowing through a blowpipe or by squeezing the bag with a bellows tucked under the upper arm, hence the name of the most common type of Irish pipes, the Illan pipes, or elbow pipes. Most pipes also have a drone, which is a pipe that produces a single constant note that underlies the melody, which is itself played on the chanter. The drone gives the bagpipes a very distinctive sound. Instruments similar to the bagpipes may have been played in various regions of Eurasia as far back as 1000 BC. But we start to know more about the pipes at the period of the Roman Empire. It's possible that the first pipes came to the island of Britain with the occupying Roman army. But there is surprisingly little solid evidence for pipes in Britain before the Middle Ages, other than what we find in texts like Gerald of Wales. The bagpipes really took off in Scotland during the 16th century, when the large pipes that we know of today as the Highland bagpipes were used as a battlefield instrument. Our old friend, the Scottish scholar George Buchanan, noted that bagpipes had replaced the trumpet on the battlefield, and they're certainly much louder. Certain Scottish Highland clans specialized in piping, and this expertise later transferred into the British Imperial regiments that were staffed with Highland soldiers. Already by the 16th century, the bagpipes had spread to Ireland, and there is even a contemporary illustration of the bagpipe used in a military context in Ireland dating to 1581. This cross-fertilization between Ireland and Scotland continued, and now, of course, the bagpipes play an integral part in the traditions of American fire departments and police departments, many of which were dominated in the 19th and 20th centuries by Irish immigrants and their descendants. Aside from the characteristically Celtic instruments mentioned by Gerald of Wales, some kind of violin-like instrument was played in Ireland since at least the 8th century. The earliest surviving example dates to the 11th century. However, this medieval Irish fiddle died out. It was replaced by the European violin in the 18th century, and both Irish and Scottish music would now be hard to imagine without the fiddle. Here we see yet another example of how adaptable the Celtic traditions are to influences from outside. It would be equally hard to imagine Celtic music without the distinctive sound of the flute or the tin whistle or penny whistle. But whistles are an even more recent arrival on the Celtic music scene. They did not really start being played in Ireland until the 19th century, when they began to be mass-produced very cheaply in Manchester, England. Similarly, the accordion and concertina are also late 19th century imports into this musical tradition. And nowadays we can add the banjo, the bouzouki, and mandolin, and the guitar, among other instruments. The sound of Celtic music is always evolving. But of course I haven't yet discussed in any detail one of the most important instruments used in Celtic music, the human voice. There are several very distinctive singing styles that are vital to this tradition. Let me just run through a couple of the most prominent. The first one is an a cappella Irish style known as Seán Nós. The term refers to the old style, and one of its most distinctive features is the use of the Irish language. There are many people who would maintain that if it's not in Irish, at least in part, then it's not Sean Nós. This is a highly ornamented style in which the artistry of the singer is expressed through the variations on the melody, and it is usually slow and often extremely sad. A very different vocal style is called lilting, which can be found in both Ireland and Scotland. Lilting is kind of like the Gaelic equivalent of scat, in which nonsense syllables are sung to a melody. Lilting could be used to accompany dancers as a substitute for a musical instrument if none were at hand. I'll mention just one more important Irish singing tradition, namely the ballad. These story songs grew out of the bardic tradition in Irish, but in the 19th century, songs began to be composed widely in English. Many were love songs, such as the beautiful Star of the County Down.
Near to Banbridge town and the County Down, one morning in July, down a Bowring Green came a sweet Colleen, and she smiled as she passed me by. Oh, she looked so neat, from her two white feet to the sheen of her nut-brown hair. Sure, the coaxing elf, I to shake myself to make sure I was standing there.
But there is also a rich tradition of explicitly political songs in Ireland, on both the nationalist and the unionist sides. From the middle of the 20th century on, singing groups such as the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makeham and the Dubliners made these songs popular around the world. While singing in the Gaelic world has emphasized solo performers until quite recently, the most famous form of singing from Wales is definitely choral singing. Gerald of Wales mentioned this tradition, but it was otherwise unrecorded until we begin to see notations of Welsh choral music in the 18th century, and that coincides with the Methodist revival movement. The Methodists privileged hymn singing over instrumental music because they regarded it as less decadent. And out of this tradition grew the very strong emphasis on the male voice choir. One of the other musical impacts of the Methodist revival in Wales was a decline in traditional Welsh dancing, about which we know much less than we would like. So it is far more to Ireland and Scotland that we need to look for the origins of the dance traditions that have proved so influential around the world. Unfortunately, we know even less about the origins of dancing in Ireland and Scotland than we do about music. There is less visual evidence that survives, and no artifacts, of course. There is not even a native word for dancing in the Irish language. The terms used today were borrowed from English and French. The earliest mention of dancing in Ireland is actually from a famous 14th century Middle English poem that calls on the listener to come and dance with me in Ireland. This poem must have been referring to the tip of a fairly large iceberg, because as we have seen with music, in the 16th century, when all kinds of written sources increased tremendously, we suddenly have lots of references to dancing. Various kinds of dances are mentioned, including the hay, the fading, and the trenchmore. Though, alas, we have no idea what these dances looked like. Dancing was reportedly very popular among the poorer classes, especially at agricultural festivals. Irish and Scottish dance really come into focus in the 18th century, at the same time as the violin was introduced. The most important dance meters were the jig and the reel. Ironically, the jig originated in England, but it became most popular in Ireland and Scotland. The jig is a triple meter with either two or three groups of three notes. A jig with three groups of three notes is called a slip jig. The reel, though, did originate in Scotland, and it then made its way to Ireland, where it became enormously popular. The reel is in double or quadruple meter, and it's usually a rapid melody with an emphasis on eighth notes. There are usually two related melodic parts that are repeated in various patterns. I just want to mention one other kind of specifically Scottish dance called the Strathspey. It's in 4/4 time, like a reel, but in contrast to the reel, it is slow and stately, characterized by a very distinctive rhythm called the Scotch snap, which is a short dotted note before a longer note. Nowadays, of course, Irish dancing in particular has become a worldwide phenomenon thanks to the success of the show Riverdance and its spin-off, Michael Flatley's Lord of the Dance. These dance extravaganzas draw on the tradition of Irish dance, but it's important to note that Irish dance as we know it today is a relatively recent phenomenon. The traditions I have been talking about went into decline, even in Ireland, in the 19th century, particularly under the withering criticism of the Catholic Church, until late in the century, when the Gaelic League decided to help revive Irish music and dance, just as they were attempting to revive the Irish language. The late 19th century also saw the beginning of the tradition of decorating dancers' costumes with explicitly Celtic motifs, to the point that many Irish dancers' dresses today look almost exactly like carpet pages from the Book of Kells. But just as the learned revival of the language attempted to introduce some standardization amidst linguistic diversity, the revival of dance led to a rather rigid codification of norms. Irish step dancing is characterized by the very distinctive emphasis on the rigid posture of the upper body, so that all of the focus is placed on the movement of the feet. This is not a feature of Scottish dance, which is somewhat similar otherwise to Irish dance. So presumably, at one point, the two forms were more similar. In Ireland, there was also a totally new emphasis on competition in both the solo and group forms of dance. The Irish dance world today is very heavily competition-driven. Of course, there are traditionalists and avant-gardists in any art form, and Celtic music and dance are no exception. Many groups today fuse traditional Celtic musical forms with new instrumentation. So, for example, earlier we heard the famous Irish ballad, The Star of the County Down. Here is a rather different version, played by the Celtic rock band Bryn Mawr. For some traditional music fans, this instrumentation takes some getting used to. For me, it was almost as much of a shock when the Irish folk group Clannad went electric as it was when Bob Dylan did so in 1965. But it's important to keep in mind, as I have noted, that the Celtic musical traditions have always been open to new instruments and new forms. Nowadays, Celtic rock and punk have become popular around the world. For example, we have the American bands Black 47 and the Dropkick Murphys. I want to finish this lecture by talking about two subjects that concern the way in which music connects the various parts of the Celtic world to each other. First, in something of a preview of what I will talk about in my final lecture in this course, I want to say something about the relationship between the musical traditions of the Celtic regions. And finally, I'll talk a bit about the ties between the British Isles specifically and the North American diaspora. I've mentioned in this lecture several times the ways in which the musical traditions of Ireland, Scotland, and Wales influenced each other. There is not as close a relationship between these regions and Brittany and Galicia, but if anything, the Celtic music scene in the Celtic regions of France and Spain is more explicitly pan-Celtic. For example, we have the Inter-Celtic Festival at Lorient in Brittany, which takes place the first week of August, and the Inter-Celtic Festival of Avilés in the Spanish autonomous region of Asturias, an aspirational Celtic nation that is trying to get accepted into the Celtic club. Exactly how deep a relationship we can really trace between the music and dance traditions of these disparate regions is very hard to say, but there are certainly some similarities in melodic style and rhythms that might suggest at least a distant kinship. With this idea of being part of a wider musical community that represents an ancient kinship is a very powerful one. It is nicely encapsulated in a piece by the Irish composer Sean Davey called The Pilgrim. The piece was commissioned in 1983 for the Glasgow Royal Concert Hall to mark the transfer of the title of European Culture City from Glasgow to Dublin. The conceit is that St. Columba goes on a voyage from Ireland through all the other Celtic countries, including Galicia. It uses musicians from all the Celtic countries, so the audience actually hears the kinship between the Celtic regions. Finally, I want to say a bit about the impact of music from Scotland and Ireland in the English-speaking world, especially the United States, where immigrants from Scotland and Ulster settled in the Appalachian Mountains and strongly influenced bluegrass and country music. Also, in the Canadian Maritimes, the Scots put down roots on Cape Breton Island, and Irish immigrants actually even mingled with the French settlers in Quebec to create a distinctive musical fusion that is uniquely Québécois. The connection is not just in the sound of this music, but in the actual lyrics to the songs. The Scotch-Irish and English settlers who came to the American colonies brought their songs with them in various versions, and they have survived in Appalachia to this day. In the late 19th century, an American scholar named Francis James Child collected 305 ballads that he found on both sides of the Atlantic. These are now known as the Child Ballads, and they include some very famous songs, like Barbara Allen and the Twa Sisters. Thus, Celtic music has been international for a long time, and Celtic music and dance are now enjoyed around the world by people with 100% Celtic ancestry or none at all. Surely, the ancient bards would be pleased.
Lecture 24, The Celts Today.
Welcome back for the final time. So we've come to the end of this course, and it's time to try to answer some of the questions we've asked along the way. One of our questions has been whether there is such a thing as a Celtic culture. Of course, what we mean by Celtic must be very carefully defined. We need to distinguish between the legacy of the ancient Celtic speakers of the time of Julius Caesar and the people of today who live in what we have come to call the Celtic fringe. As we've seen, it's not a simple matter to draw a direct line between the ancient Celts and the Celts of today. One scholar once claimed that an ancient Irish warrior could walk into a Dublin pub and fit right in. I do not think that would work out at all well. Let's keep in mind that the ancient Celts supposedly would kill each other over who deserved the choicest cut of meat at the feast. And even if we accept that such stories are exaggerations, I think it's still a stretch to say that there would be any kind of deep affinity between people of 2,000 years ago and today. But modern inhabitants of the Celtic regions have made a conscious effort to connect with their ancestors. So the Celts of the past and the Celts of today do have certain things in common, and especially the ones that have made Celtic culture so popular around the world, such as a pronounced love for literature and music and art and even sports. These areas of artistic endeavor had special salience in ancient Celtic societies because they called for great expertise, and in societies that were too poor to demonstrate their wealth in monumental building, for example, expertise was the ultimate form of conspicuous display. The more skillful your poet, the richer you were. And I think today we're also impressed by the tremendous skill of artists and musicians and writers. Let me give you an example of how the Celtic legacy still speaks to us today. One of my favorite films is The Secret of Kells, an animated film from 2009 that tells the story of the creation of the Book of Kells and its miraculous preservation from Viking attacks. In the film, the intricate interlace ornament and the magical beasts in this beautiful manuscript literally come to life on the screen. The movie itself is a testament to the success of the Celtic revival movement, because it was the rediscovery of the Celts in the modern period that made Celtic art so popular that it can serve as a metaphor for the need to preserve and celebrate beauty, even when faced with violence. The Celts of today have all the advantages of their rich cultural heritage, and they gladly share them with the rest of the world. In this final lecture, I want to present an overview of the Celtic world today. First, I'll talk about the Celtic phenomenon as a whole by tracing the history of the so-called pan-Celtic movement over the past century or so. Then we'll talk about the individual Celtic regions comparatively and consider two related questions, politics and language. Questions of Celtic identity are still salient in political debates today, including the movements for regional autonomy in Brittany and Galicia, the ongoing political struggle in Northern Ireland, and the debate over Scottish independence. We will see that questions regarding language and political autonomy, or even independence, play out differently in these areas, depending on a variety of factors. There is no single Celtic response to these issues. First, let's look at the pan-Celtic movement. The origins of the pan-Celtic movement date to the late 19th century, at the same time as the Gaelic revival in Ireland. And like the Gaelic revival, pan-Celticism was part of the wider European romantic nationalist current that included movements such as pan-Slavism. In 1900, the Celtic Association was formed to promote Celtic culture, and it began holding frequent pan-Celtic congresses. These meetings included some of the trappings of Celtic revivalism that we looked at earlier. For example, congresses would open with neo-druidic ceremonies. Some of the more radical proponents of pan-Celticism, such as the Celtic League, founded in 1961, actually want to reunite the Celtic realms under a single Celtic political authority. This would, of course, mean that all of the Celtic realms, except the Republic of Ireland, would need to secede from the nation-states of which they are currently a part. This is, admittedly, a radical fringe position, and there is no realistic chance of any such unified Celtic state ever materializing. And by the way, it never existed in reality. Nevertheless, the Celtic League is a United Nations-accredited non-governmental organization. One of the political undercurrents of pan-Celticism is resistance to an imperial authority, whether it be in London, Paris, or Madrid. Modern pan-Celticists thus draw an analogy between the resistance to Rome by the ancient Celts and their own resistance to centralizing authority today. Such an analogy is full of problems, of course, as all analogies are, but this is a clear case where pan-Celticists have found a usable past. But over the past century or so, the pan-Celtic movement has faced a serious issue, defining what Celtic means. The number of areas that claim Celtic associations is constantly expanding. The first pan-Celtic Congress included just 5 Celtic realms: Ireland, Brittany, Wales, Scotland, and the Isle of Man. Not until 1904 did Cornwall manage to claw its way into the linguistically minded Congress. It faced opposition at first because of the moribund status of the Cornish language. And Galicia has never made it into the Celtic Congress because there really is no viable Galician Celtic language. The relationship between Galicia and the more politically oriented Celtic League is even more contentious. In 1986, Galicia did manage to gain entry to the Celtic League, but this proved extremely controversial due to the linguistic issue. And the following year, Galicia was ejected from the Celtic League. To this day, Galicia receives no representation in the Celtic League's constitution and does not appear on the map of the Celtic realms on the Celtic League's homepage, although the Celtic League does include Spanish as one of its languages, along with English and French and the Celtic languages of the 6 official Celtic countries. This does not stop Galicia from behaving like a wannabe Celtic nation. Galician tourist materials regularly trade on the Celtic connection. And here I think we see a fascinating example of the Celtic loop being closed. As you may recall, the medieval Book of Invasions stated that the sons of Meal had come to Ireland from Spain, specifically from the tower in A Coruña in Galicia that was originally a Roman lighthouse. It had become associated with a legendary king named Brogan, and this name probably was a corruption of the name Brigantia, which actually referred to the region, not to a specific ruler. These legends were well known in both Ireland and Spain due to trading contacts, and in 1602, when the Irish rebel leader Red Hugh O'Donnell arrived in Spain after his defeat at the Battle of Kinsale, he was taken to see the lighthouse, because that seemed the logical place to take a visiting Irishman. This connection between Ireland and Spain has been highlighted recently by the local Galician authorities, who have erected several Celtic-themed monuments, including a statue of King Brogan, which is very popular with tourists today, and, very tellingly, a compass rose mosaic of the 7 Celtic nations, including Galicia. Of course, these assertions of the status of Galicia as a Celtic region are very much tied up in an ongoing debate within Spain about autonomy for its various regions. Galicia is not going to give up knocking on the Celtic door, and nearby Asturias is also interested in getting in on the act. There is even a small movement to recognize Switzerland as a Celtic nation, since it was, of course, once inhabited by Celtic speakers. One of my favorite manifestations of this movement is the Swiss folk metal band Helvetii, whose songs frequently deal with Celtic mythology, and the lyrics are often sung in a reconstructed form of ancient Gaulish. But it's fair to say that these issues of who is in and who is out of the Celtic club do not preoccupy the vast majority of people in the Celtic regions. Instead, the Celtic question comes up most frequently regarding debates over political autonomy and language policy. So now that we have given Galicia its curtain call, let's do a quick tour of the rest of the Celtic world. Let's start with the Isle of Man. The Isle of Man has been a cultural melting pot through the centuries and has changed hands numerous times. But since the 14th century, it has been ruled by England, though its status is a bit peculiar. The Isle of Man is not governed directly by the United Kingdom's Parliament. Instead, it has considerable autonomy for internal affairs, while defense and external matters are handled by the British government. Manx citizens even carry special passports that spell out their special status. There's a political party on the Isle of Man called the Liberal Vanin Party that argues for even greater legislative autonomy, but it has attracted only limited support. Since 1985, Manx has been one of the 2 official languages of the Isle of Man, even though in the 2011 census, only about 2% of the Manx population of 85,000 claimed to be able to speak the Manx language. And Manx is officially recognized under the European Charter for Regional or Minority Languages. Road signs are bilingual throughout the island, and some broadcasting is available in Manx. All Manx children have the option to take Manx in school, though it is not required, and there is one Manx immersion school on the island. Still, Manx is considered to be critically endangered. Let's jump down now to the next largest of the Celtic regions, Cornwall. Cornwall participated in the 19th century Celtic revival, but by that point, the Cornish language had largely died out. To some Celtic activists, this state of affairs clearly needed to be remedied. Henry Jenner, a pivotal Cornish revivalist, said, "Why should Cornishmen learn Cornish? Because they are Cornishmen." And this mirrors what some Irish nationalists were saying about the Irish language at the same time, that Irish people should speak Irish. It just went without saying. But the marginal status of Cornwall and Cornish made it harder for the Cornish revival movement to get taken seriously by the larger Celtic powers, as evidenced by their difficulties with the Pan-Celtic Congress and the Celtic League. Then there were arguments among Cornish activists over the right way to spell Cornish, which certainly didn't help. But starting in the 1990s, things really got rolling. There are now bilingual street signs in Cornwall, just as there are on the Isle of Man. There is a bilingual Cornish-English daycare center where parents also take special classes in Cornish so that they can reinforce the Cornish that their kids are learning. BBC Cornwall broadcasts a certain amount of Cornish, and books are increasingly available in Cornish. You can actually buy The Hobbit in Cornish. In 2011, the British Census recorded 557 people who claimed Cornish as their main language, and 3,000 people claimed to be fluent. UNESCO has changed the status of Cornish from extinct to revived, but they still consider it critically endangered, like Manx. It's interesting, isn't it, that we use the same vocabulary for languages that we do for endangered species, because there are, in fact, many similarities between models of languages and models of living things. With regard to politics, there is a small movement that favors autonomy for Cornwall, largely on the basis of the Celtic heritage of the Cornish people, but it does not enjoy widespread support. A petition was launched in 2011 to grant Cornwall parliamentary status as an official minority, but it received only 851 signatures, well short of the 100,000 required to trigger a debate. Efforts to create a devolved legislative assembly for Cornwall, on a par with the parliaments in Wales and Scotland, have gained little traction. However, Cornwall did enjoy a moment at the center of a national controversy in 2012. It concerned the Cornish pasty, a special hot pocket-style sandwich consisting of meat and potatoes inside a pastry crust. The pasty was traditionally taken down into the tin mines in Cornwall, and it is a cultural icon in Britain to this day. In 2012, the British government tried to impose a tax on prepared foods, and the opponents of the tax were able to block the new tax by calling it the pasty tax. This would have been the British equivalent of taxing hot dogs or apple pie, and the British were having none of it, so the tax was defeated. Of course, this example actually shows how integrated Cornish culture is into mainstream British culture. I'm going to jump across the sea now to another Brittonic country, Brittany. And I'm going to discuss it in a wider French context. The resonance of the Celts in France actually cuts in two directions. On the one hand, there is the legacy of the Gauls. This legacy has looked different at different points in French history. In the 19th century, the French were fascinated with all things Celtic. To take just one example, the otherwise rather obscure French poet Alexandre Soumet wrote a verse tragedy called Norma, about a druid priestess who falls in love with a Roman officer. In 1831, the poem was turned into an opera by Vincenzo Bellini that is still widely performed today, often with the druids dressed in the, by now, obligatory white robes. So for 19th century French people, the Celts gave them a connection to their mysterious past. But the Celts had a quite different resonance in the mid-20th century. During the Vichy period, Some people saw the defeat of the Gauls as a prudent and beneficial concession to the march of progress. Thus, they argued, the French should surrender to the Germans and join in a new and better Europe. Of course, not everyone agreed. And in the post-war years, a quite different picture of the relationship between Rome and the Gauls emerged. In 1959, Asterix the Gaul, written by René Goscinny and illustrated by Albert Uderzo, tells the story of a Gaulish warrior who lives in the last village to hold out against Julius Caesar and the Romans. And the Romans are treated as buffoons, incapable of subduing this tiny Gaulish settlement. Of course, Asterix does have a magic potion prepared by his druid friend, which probably helps, but still, he symbolizes resistance to outside forces. And here the Romans clearly stand in for the Nazis. The series now numbers more than 30 books. Asterix contains many authentic touches that come right out of Julius Caesar's descriptions of the Gauls, such as the fondness of the Gauls for wine. In the stories, we see Roman wine amphorae all over the place. The Gaulish characters also all have names ending in ix, like the real Gaulish chieftain Vercingetorix, even if many of the names constitute groan-worthy puns. So in these instances, the Gauls are used to help French people think about the relationship between France as a whole and its neighbors in the rest of Europe. But the Brittany question is quite different, because here, the unity of France is at stake. The ambivalence of the relationship between Brittany and the rest of France can be seen in a very famous French family, the de Gaulles. Charles de Gaulle the Elder, the uncle of the more famous French statesman, was a 19th century writer who became fascinated by the pan-Celtic movement. He learned Breton, and he wrote Breton language poetry. Fast forward to the 1960s, when President Charles de Gaulle enacted a number of measures to crack down on Breton separatism. In 1968, while on a visit to Brittany to try to smooth things over, he tried to trade on his uncle's literary reputation by declaiming one of his Breton poems. Given that de Gaulle had recently agitated for independence for Quebec on the grounds of linguistic tradition, de Gaulle's use of the Breton poem struck the hostile crowd as hypocritical, and they drowned out the rest of the speech. These days, Breton separatism is not very strong. Fewer than 20% of those polled in 2013 want Brittany to be independent, though many more than that would probably support greater autonomy from the central government. Breton identity is more tied up in Breton cultural traditions, such as the Celtic circles that dedicate themselves to the music, literature, language, and distinctive customs of Brittany, including the beautiful traditional lace headdresses that have undergone a recent revival. There are about 200 to 300 such Celtic circles in Brittany, as well as a few others around the world. The Breton language, unfortunately, has undergone a steep decline in recent years. In the early 20th century, there were about 2 million Breton speakers. But as of 2007, the number had shrunk to about 200,000, heavily concentrated in the western part of the Breton Peninsula. Although most other Celtic regions afford some protected status to their indigenous languages, Breton has no official support, and France has not so far ratified the European Charter for Regional or Minority Languages. There are some bilingual signs, but far fewer than in most other Celtic regions. There are private schools in Brittany that teach in Breton through immersion, reaching some 15,000 students, but it is illegal in France to use any other language besides French as the language of instruction in a public school. On a positive note, however, the Asterix comics have been translated into Breton. That said, there is no particular correlation between the level of survival of the Celtic languages and the level of separatist sentiment. Wales has by far the highest proportion of Celtic language speakers of any of the Celtic realms. The 2011 census showed 562,000 Welsh speakers, about 19% of the population. This is by far the largest number of speakers of any Celtic language anywhere. and this is certainly partly due to the strong support for Welsh in the schools. All Welsh students take Welsh in school until at least age 14, and about 16% of students go to Welsh medium schools. This is the highest percentage of students to be educated primarily in a Celtic language of any of the Celtic regions. In Ireland, where Irish is one of two official languages, the percentage of students learning primarily through Irish is only 6%. And bilingual street signs in Welsh and English have been standard throughout Wales since the 1970s. Nevertheless, the Welsh are markedly less separatist than the Irish or the Scots. The Welsh Nationalist Party, which is known as Plaid Cymru, or Children of Wales, has never managed to seize control of Welsh local politics the way the Scottish National Party has in Scotland. The Welsh were granted their own legislative assembly in 1998, since upgraded to a parliament, on a much narrower referendum vote than the Scots. Wales voted 50.3 in favor of devolution versus 49.7 against, in contrast to the Scots, who voted 74-26 in favor. Of course, in September 2014, Scotland held a second referendum, this time on independence, that ended in a convincing victory for the no vote. Since then, political observers have been carefully watching the polls for the impact of various events on support for independence, with the understanding that the Scottish National Party is just biding its time for a second referendum. At the same time that nationalist sentiment in Scotland has grown, support for the Gaelic language has risen as well, though the numbers are still tiny compared to Wales or Ireland. In 2016, there were nearly 4,000 students studying in Gaelic medium schools, and only about 10,000 were learning any Gaelic in school at all, a mere 1.6% of the country's student population. Although there are now Gaelic language broadcasts on both TV and radio, the amount of programming is still less than is available in Welsh or Irish. Bilingual street signs are seen in Scotland mostly in the Highlands and Islands, and even there they have sometimes caused controversy. So in Scotland, support for the indigenous Celtic language is not correlated with support for political autonomy, perhaps because the revival of Scottish identity in the 19th century focused on cultural features such as the tartan rather than on the linguistic heritage of the early Celtic-speaking inhabitants. Of course, the situation is very different in Ireland. I mentioned that the Irish language played a very large part in the rise of Irish nationalism. Many nationalists, who never attained much fluency in Irish, nevertheless paid lip service, at the very least, to the desirability of reviving Irish. And in the early years of the Irish Free State in the 1920s, a serious effort was made to make Irish the everyday language of the people. The use of Irish as a mark of identity is controversial to this day. Today, enormous resources are poured into supporting the Irish language. Nevertheless, the number of active users of Irish stubbornly refuses to climb, despite the fact that the Irish language is compulsory for all Irish school children, and it's a mandatory subject in the Leaving Certificate exam, which is similar to the French baccalaureate or the German Abitur. The state broadcaster in Ireland, RTE, runs Irish language channels in both radio and television, and of course, there are now many Irish language websites. Irish is compulsory in the public service, since Irish citizens have the right to demand that they interact with the government through Irish. The major political parties in Ireland have periodically gotten into hot water if they seem to waver at all in their support for the Irish language, which is often seen as a measure of patriotism, despite the fact that many Irish politicians are not really all that competent in the language. In one particularly striking episode in 2014, it emerged that a junior minister named Joe McHugh was not a fluent speaker of Irish, despite the fact that he was being appointed to work in the Department of Arts, Heritage, and Gaeltacht Affairs. That is to say, he was going to be in charge of policy for the Gaeltachta, which refers to all the areas of Ireland that have officially been designated as Irish-speaking. The Gaeltacht is seen by many as a kind of repository of authentic Irishness, precisely because the language survives there. But there are certainly plenty of other people who have no particular affinity with Irish and simply resent having to learn it in school. My own experience of Irish language instruction in an Irish high school was not very encouraging. It was taught a lot like Latin, like a dead language rather than a living tongue. There have been some countervailing trends in recent years, however, with the growing popularity in Ireland of what are referred to as Irish medium schools. That is, schools where the primary language of instruction is Irish. Irish schools, or Gaelscoile, tend to attract very well-educated parents and produce very high-achieving students. It remains unclear, however, whether students who are educated in Irish language schools go on to speak Irish more in their daily lives than other students. Irish language policy can be controversial in the Republic of Ireland, but it is even more politically sensitive in Northern Ireland. In the Republic, there is at least a broad consensus that there is a connection between the Irish language and Irish identity. Even people who really resent having to learn Irish might feel a bit guilty about feeling that way. But in Northern Ireland, where the population is divided between people who identify themselves primarily as Irish and people who identify themselves primarily as British, there is a long history of Irish being used as a marker of radical nationalism. For example, during the Troubles of the 1960s through the 1980s, among nationalist prisoners, some of the most popular classes they could take in prison were Irish language courses. Of course, very happily, Northern Ireland is now at peace, though many issues remain to be solved, including issues of identity that are partially expressed by means of language. One of the two nationalist parties, Sinn Féin, whose name means "we ourselves" in Irish, has advocated strongly for an act to foster the Irish language. Their political opponents, called unionists because they believe in supporting the union between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, are much less receptive to the Irish language, and in fact, they fairly clearly believe that efforts by Sinn Féin to encourage more bilingual street signs are just part of an effort to make trouble. The unionists have countered with the suggestion there should also be special status for what they call Ulster Scots, which is the vernacular that developed in Northern Ireland out of the Scots dialect spoken by Ulster's 17th century settlers. And language is not the only cultural issue that divides North and South in Ireland. Another very salient issue is sports. I've talked about how the Gaelic Athletic Association is central to the national identity of the Republic of Ireland, and it's woven into the political fabric of the nation. For male Irish politicians in particular, it can be a huge asset to have played GAA sports for their county, much the way success in college or professional athletics is an asset to an American politician. The reason the GAA is controversial politically is that GAA games are played as county versus county competitions in all 32 counties of the island of Ireland. In certain strongly nationalist neighborhoods of Belfast, such as the Ardoyne, highly sectarian murals celebrate the nationalist credentials of the GAA. One famous example depicting GAA players has the words, "Welcome to the Ardoyne," in Irish at the top. And it also has the four provincial flags of Ireland on the corners, meaning that all four provinces of Ireland belong under one government. The GAA is so nationalist, in fact, that until quite recently, members of the GAA were forbidden to play so-called foreign games, which really meant sports that had been introduced into Ireland from England, including soccer, rugby, and of course, cricket. In response to this nationalist exclusivity, members of the British security forces were forbidden to play Gaelic games. Of course, this rule became obsolete in the south of Ireland after Irish independence, but it was very much in effect in Northern Ireland, where members of the local police force, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, or RUC, were barred from GAA membership. The ban was lifted in 2001 when a new, explicitly non-sectarian police force known as the Police Service of Northern Ireland, or PSNI, replaced the RUC. The subject of Gaelic games is still rather touchy in Northern Ireland. It can cause controversy if a unionist politician attends a GAA match, though more and more unionists are seeing the value of appealing to GAA fans in their constituencies. Sports might be starting to help break down some very old social boundaries, but the process has a long way to go. So how can we sum up over 2,000 years of the Celtic phenomenon? This is a tall order, of course, but it's useful to give it a try. Let me return to a topic I have mentioned several times before. Who are the Celts? And specifically, what can modern DNA analysis tell us about their origins? Recent work has shown that the residents of the so-called Celtic fringe had probably been living in these areas for thousands of years before the people known to the classical authors as the Celts were active on the continent. And there is no close link between these people and Central Europe, where the Celts arose. DNA can fairly conclusively refute the old Celtic hypothesis about a Celtic invasion of Britain and Ireland. Some scholars have suggested that since the people the Romans and the Greeks knew as the Celts are clearly not the same people as the residents of Ireland and Britain, it is now time to get rid of the word Celtic altogether. But I don't think this is the right approach. As we have seen, the word Celtic has many meanings. Even if there were no particular genetic connections between the Celts of the continent and the British Isles and Ireland, there were clearly many connections in art, language, and culture. People can share a culture and even a language without sharing DNA. And the same cultural fluidity that operated in the ancient world is even more prevalent today. Celtic culture is not the province of any one ethnic group. It is there to be embraced by anyone who was inspired by great art, literature, and music, and by the fascinating story of the relationship between peoples who were marginalized politically, but nevertheless had a disproportionate impact on world culture. Today, there are St. Patrick's Day parades, not just in almost every state in the USA and every country in Europe, but in China, Japan, and Singapore as well. And the World Pipe Band Championships, held in Glasgow, attract bagpipers from around the world. Whiskey, or Ishkibaha, the water of life, has never been more popular in both its Irish version with an E and its Scottish version without. But the Celts are about more than parades and bagpipes and whiskey. The Celtic story is also about the persistence of art and creativity in the face of adversity. And as such, I think it belongs to people of all backgrounds. The Celtic world is for everyone.
We hope you have enjoyed these lectures from the Great Courses. Our courses are available online or via the free The Great Courses app for smartphones and tablets, available on the App Store or Google Play. View our full library at thegreatcourses.com. Or as always, you can call our customer care representatives at 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.